Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Please be seated. We've got lots of. Thought we'd do a little text study today. Figured it'd be a small group. We had our big Pride Shabbat celebrations last night, and the parade is tomorrow as well. And we have downstairs Minyan. So, what I want to do is actually study how an ancient society, meaning our people's society, dealt with one of its dark and difficult problems. And let's set a little guideline around that every society, when it gets to core and intractable problems, never really gets it 100% right. And the goal in us looking at this and studying it is not that we imagine it would want to set up our society this way. I don't think any of us, certainly speaking personally, the issue around the sota and husband's jealousy, this is certainly not my solution and one that would not at all be good in our time. So we can push that sort of concern away right away and sort of recognize that societies, we don't know how we want to deal with the anger and violence of our school shooters, right? As a society, we can't come up with an answer. We don't know how we want to deal with transsexual people, right? We had a military inclusion, and we rolled it back. And while each of us may have our answer, as a society, we are unable to come up with a solution that satisfies the majority. Fair? And that's sort of the problems when we have these very intractable problems in society. So what is the sota ritual about? Hopefully some of you got a chance to look at it in chapter 5 with those verses. A husband is jealous, angry. He is convinced that his wife has had an affair with someone, and yet there is no evidence of it. Evidence in the Bible in all sorts of places for very good reasons requires witnesses. The witnesses have to warn you that you're about to do something you're not allowed to do. The person has to say, I know, and I still want to do it. And those are all really good legal protections. So this is a sense where he just has this intuition. And we know from studies that about if somebody thinks their partner is having an affair, there's about a 50% chance they're right. So on the one hand, we're dealing with just like one person's emotions, which they can't deal with. On the other hand, we're dealing with this other aspect that maybe they're not just reacting just to their own unresolved issues. But more importantly, the ancient world took care of its people by this very specific notion of marriage. And that a woman in that society who would be divorced or gotten left from the relationship would be in a very weakened state legally. She really would not have a lot of rights. So there was certainly a desire to maintain those protections for everyone. That's the world. We don't have to like that. We should be very grateful we live in the time we are, and I think we've advanced substantially, though with some of our intractable problems we haven't. So the Torah is presented with this, and it's going to say, what do we do with this? How do we restore a relationship? What do we do with this? Is divorce the proper answer? How do we restore some semblance of love, normalcy in a ruptured relationship? That's the background to it. So I'm gonna what I'm really gonna be teaching today is out of an article by the wonderful Professor Hannah Liss, who's at Heidelberg, and the position she puts by bringing forward a bunch of texts is one that one of my teachers in rabbinical school had put when we would learn this sort of through the Talmud and the Mishnah, etc. So let's just go. So we know what the Torah says. The Torah says that a husband suspects his wife of adultery. They go together to the central rite, the tent of meeting, the temple, and in later days, right? And she is given a potion that is a part of the dust of the ground and that has God's name And she's told to say a formula, and that if she has committed adultery, her thigh will distend. We don't know what that means, whether it's uterine prolapse. Nobody knows what it is. But that if she's innocent, she will become pregnant. Which I got to say, if she was, you know, it's actually sort of, it's an interesting notion, right? Is that because the husband and she are reunited? Is it because the Torah understood this was a way to make sure that a child would not be unwanted and not taken care of? We don't know, but that's sort of the background. So the Mishnah is looking at this long after this initial practice sort of came about. And if you look on page one, can I get somebody to read that first text? Just jump in, someone.
When adultery became rampant, the bitter waters ceased, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai canceled their use, as it said, I will not punish their daughters for fornicating or their daughters in law for committing adultery, for they themselves sinned.
Okay, so by the time of the Mishnah, we're talking about the year 200 or so, and really before, because it's only finished then. People sort of realized that this magical formula wasn't really working. And to put it into perspective, right, in the ancient world, there were other cultures that took a much worse stance. There was a place where, I believe it was Egypt, actually, where a woman would be required to swim in a river, and if she drowned, she was guilty, and if she didn't drown, she was innocent. So it's a little bit like the witch trials. We've evolved a little bit as a species, but this is sort of the background to that. And later on, by the time the mission of this, yep.
I think there were those trials where if you drowned, they determined that you were innocent.
Is that what it was? How much do you want out of this marriage? All right, so I will have to check on that and see. Cute. So anyway, by the time of the Mishnah, though, they're realizing this is not working anymore. And what the Mishnah is saying is that because of us and where we were as a society, the ritual failed. And if we can get someone, Jeff, would you read us from the Rambam, Nachmanides?
No, there's nothing.
We have trying to get all the Jeffs to read today. Okay, so Nachmanides is saying sexual mores changed, and if you know Ramban, even though he's a mystic, this is his way of saying, first of all, the Torah doesn't rely on mitzvah, on magic and on miracles. And this is the only example in the Torah, in Nachmanides' perspective, where a law is fulfilled through this semi-magical or mystical sort of perspective instead of just a normal sort of issue. So we're going to keep moving on now, and Mindy, would you read, please?
If any man's wife has gone astray and broken faith with him, and that a man has had carnal relations with her unbeknown to her husband, and she keeps secret the fact that she has been defiled, and there is no witness against her, she was not caught, but a fit of jealousy comes over him, and it is brought up about the wife who has defiled herself. Or if a fit of jealousy comes over one and he is brought up about his wife, although she has not defiled herself.
All right, anyone notice what's missing from this description?
The consequence.
Right, so my grandfather taught me a long time ago. And this is a perfect example in the Bible of a big fancy cocktail words of your protasis and your apodosis. Your protasis is the if then sort of situation. And it's how the Torah works repeatedly in its legislation. Here's what if you do this, and here's the consequence. Here's what will happen legally. So there is no consequence to here. This is all the setup, and the setup really defines actually what is what's essential. So if you flip your page, we'll sort of get to the next part then, which is then the man shall bring his wife to the priest. And by understanding how the Torah works with the structure, we understand that the real essence of this is not her behavior, but his jealousy. This is what Hannah lists, and it's what my professor sort of put forward, that the essence of the wrongdoing is not what she did, but his reaction to it. And so a question sort of arises, if that's the case, why not divorce? And we know from elsewhere in the Torah, right, if you go to Numbers 24 or you go to Deuteronomy, we understand that if there's something that happens in the relationship that is very disturbing, the power for divorce in the Torah is given to the husband and he sends her away. And that's the normal form. This is not, and the reason for it was that in order to restore that relationship, if someone had this sexual relationship outside of marriage, they were not permitted. The husband, in this case, would not be permitted to go back and be with his wife again. You might look at this as a control for STDs. You might look at this to deal with issues of tumah and tahara, of ritual purity. But in any case, they are not permitted to go to reconnect unless something happens. And this ritual is sort of what occurs in there. And we have one more model to sort of understand this, and it goes really into the book of Ezekiel. And I'm going to just summarize for the sake of time that here God is in the place of the husband, and the Israelites are in the place of the adulterous party, and God is not allowed to be with the Jewish people until this process of dealing with jealousy is handled. And that concludes with the grain offering in number, that the husband shall bring an offering, a barley flour, and they bring it together, and after that, the marriage has a chance of being restored. Go ahead, Ruby. Right, so again, this is when we don't have proof. The Torah says quite clearly, right, if we catch people, you get the ultimate penalty. Well, the second to ultimate. The ultimate is karet, the next down is a nice public stoning. So we, right, in those circumstances where there is evidence and proof and we know who it is, absolutely there's a consequence for both parties in there. But what Hanalis is really talking about is how do you restore a relationship in a society which has a whole bunch of boundaries as to what it means to be in a relationship and when are we permitted to one another and what do we do with sort of dark and difficult emotions that create these rifts to it. And I really just was struck by this, not the container of it, but the meaning for us, right? Like, what would it mean in our society if we had a way for people to process tremendous anger? When we think about all these school shootings and these mass shootings, almost all of them are people who have had a relationship in that institution, whether it's a school, whether it's a Navy yard, if you remember that attack a number of years ago. And we don't have a way to really help provide that on a societal level, right? Some people say we should eliminate guns. It doesn't deal with the human element for these sorts of things. But the Torah is wrestling with that which is real for it and for the sorts of relationships that existed in their time. And so I guess what I want you to sort of think about with our corollary are where, in what ways does our society have answers for some of our large problems? And when don't we? And what might we come up with to help find solutions to difficult issues which break apart the very structure of society. Shabbat shalom. Yep.